From the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Tzav. This week, Pesach is coming very soon. So two things to bring to your attention. The first is that we will have a special Pesach podcast. So check your podcast feed for that. You'll see it shortly. And the second is that we have many more electronic learning resources available for you about Pesach. Go to our electronic learning site, that's elmad.pardes.org for all the information and the place to download materials to help make your Pesach Seder ever more meaningful. This week, Tzav with Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parsha Tzav. Before I go into an analysis of the parsha, I would like to thank Marnie Mandel for sponsoring this podcast. Marnie is a Pardes alum, a former student of mine, with whom I had numerous discussions both inside and outside of the class, a supporter of Pardes for the last 20 years. So Marnie, I am truly honored that you have decided to sponsor my podcast. Let me begin. When I was growing up, I always found Parshat Tzav to be very difficult to relate to. As some of you may know, I have consistently been reading Torah in the Beit Knesset for over 50 years. And during my youth, I would always have a kind of mental block in preparing Parshat Tzav. I found it very hard to connect with the things that were being discussed. A breakthrough came when I was introduced to the commentary of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the leading Orthodox rabbi in Germany in the mid to late 1800s. Rabbi Hirsch's commentary, especially on the book of Vayikra, gave me a whole new insight into sacrifices, into ritual purity, into reading the text through the lenses of someone who is looking for meaning. Over 30 years ago, I actually gave a course in Pardes on the book of Vayikra from the beginning. And this is something which was the beginning of a journey of getting new insights into the laws of the sacrifice, the temple, ritual purity, and to somehow find a way of connecting what would seem to be archaic laws to our reality. So with this as our background, let us get to our subject. One of the things that always troubled me was the repetition in the beginning of our parsha of the sacrifices. In last week's parsha, we go through the various sacrifices, and it seems as if we're rehashing things in the beginning of our parsha. But in fact, although we may be discussing similar sacrifices, we are looking at them from a very, very different angle. As Rabbi Hirsch points out, in last week's parsha, we are looking at the sacrifices from the vantage point of the one who is bringing them, what we could call your average Jew. In this week's parsha, we are looking at the sacrifices through the lenses of the one who is performing the service, Aaron and his sons, the priests. And although we're discussing the same sacrifices, they are not listed in the same order. In last week's parsha, we discuss the burnt offering, the peace offering, and then eventually we discuss the sin and guilt offerings. In our parsha, we also start off with the burnt offering, but then we talk about the sin offering, the guilt offering, and only at the end do we talk about the peace offering. Why? In last week's parsha, we are actually beginning with those offerings which are voluntary, and we eventually go into those offerings which are obligatory. But it's not only that. In last week's parsha, if we are talking about the offerings from the vantage point of the one who is bringing them, we want to show that the motivation for bringing offerings should be voluntary, should be coming from a place of wanting to come near to God. The root of the word korban is karov, which means near. My purpose in bringing the sacrifice is to bring me closer to God. As Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch notes, this was a major difference between the Jewish understanding of sacrifices and the pagan understanding of sacrifices. And the major distinction was rooted on the Jewish understanding of God versus the pagan understanding of God. From a pagan perspective, the gods were seen as hostile, inimical forces who threaten us. For that reason, when they come in, so to speak, we need to buy them off. We need to bring them a sacrifice which will propitiate them, which will, quote-unquote, get them off our backs. The whole purpose of the sacrifice was to keep the gods far away from us. And one can actually see this in Shemot, when Moshe comes before Pharaoh, and Moshe needs to explain to him, this is chapter 5 in the book of Shemot, why the Jews need to go out for 3 days in the desert to worship their God. Moshe says, because our God has come in, and if we don't go out, we will be hurt, either by a pestilence or by the sword. Moshe was speaking the language that Pharaoh would understand. But from a Jewish perspective, our understanding of God is a God who loves us, who nurtures us, who is interested in our well-being. And hence, one brings a sacrifice in order to be close to God. And therefore, it is totally logical that in last week's parsha, when we discuss the sacrifices, the first sacrifice to discuss is the voluntary sacrifice that we bring. The voluntary sacrifice, the Korban Olah, which is to express our total devotion to God. It is only at the end of last week's parsha that we discuss those sacrifices that are coming to repair our relationship with God. The sin offerings, the guilt offerings. And even there, we see the medium of the sacrifices as being an expression of God's love, of God's compassion, of God's willingness to accept the sacrifice in lieu of punishment, of affliction. Because God is ultimately a God who wants us to live, and for whom the sacrifices become a way of enabling us to live as a kind of educational model. The sacrifice is us. What happens to the sacrifice should have happened to us. But ultimately, God does not want our lives to be given up. God wants us to learn so that we should live and ultimately repair our relationship with God. Everything which I have said now is last week's parsha. But in this week's parsha, the order is different. In this week's parsha, we go from the sacrifices that are the holiest to the sacrifices that are less holy. And one might even say, in this parsha, we're not actually looking at the voluntary versus the obligatory, but focusing even more on the obligatory, but within that realm, to go from the holiest to the less holy. The Korban Olah, what is known as the burnt offering, is the holiest of sacrifices because it is totally consumed on the altar. It is completely given over to God. Below it is the Korban Mincha, a meal offering, which interestingly, if brought by a priest, must be completely consumed on the altar. But if brought by a regular Jew, has a portion which is placed on the altar, and the rest is eaten by the priests. In the language of the rabbis in the Talmud, when the priests are eating, partaking of the sacrifice, they are sitting at the table of God. It's as if God is allowing them to share at his table, the table being the altar. And hence, the eating of the sacrifices by the priest is a holy act. And when the priests do this, they need to see this as if they are somehow, as I said, at the table of God, being given a portion to be eaten in service of God. And then when we go on to the sin offering and the guilt offering, these are also offerings that are eaten by the priests, that must be eaten in the temple courtyard. And finally, when we get to the peace offering is what's called Kodashim Kalim, a lesser level of holiness, which can actually be eaten by regular Jews and do not need to be eaten in the temple courtyard, but must be eaten in the city of Jerusalem. If we think about this for a minute, it becomes a fascinating concept because this sets the tone for something that people may be familiar with. Our rabbis say that our table where we eat is an altar. Every time we sit down to a meal, it should actually be a holy experience. And in a way, when we have a meal, it should be informed by the way the priests eat the sacrifices. Just as the priests eat the sacrifices in a holy space, see themselves before God, see what they're doing as part of a much larger service of God, so too, when we sit at a meal, we should make it into a religious experience. I know that there are cynics who will say, yes, every time I eat, it's a religious experience because eating, stuffing myself, is my religion. But that's not what I'm talking about. And I think this raises a very interesting question for us. How do we sit down and eat? To what extent is it that we do see eating as being part of our relationship with God? This is why the rabbis instituted that before a meal, one needs to ritually wash their hands, similar to the priests, before they would begin the temple service, would wash their hands and feet. We need to make blessings on our food. We need to make the blessings not only before we eat, but to make blessings after we eat. And in so doing, we acknowledge God as the source of our food. It's as if we ask God before we eat for permission to eat of that which God has given us. And then when we finish, we thank God for all the bounty that we have. From a rabbinic perspective, it would be very appropriate to say words of Torah at a meal, at any meal. In fact, the rabbis even say that any meal where words of Torah are not said, is like the sacrifices of the dead, which is a term that's used for pagan sacrifices. I think many people appreciate this, especially on Shabbat. When on Shabbat, people are more aware, more sensitive to saying words of Torah at their meal, to singing songs of praise, mirot, to God. But in fact, this is something that we should be doing at every meal. And this is something which was characteristic of the priests when they were eating the sacrifices. So that, in fact, this law of sacrifices is not just something of what was once upon a time, but actually becomes an educational model for what should be outside of the temple, inside our homes, so that our homes become a holy space. Our relationship with God should not be something which is limited to the Beit Knesset, to the synagogue, or to the Beit Midrash, to the house of study. It should not just be about prayer or study. Our relationship with God should be reflected in our eating, which is a central feature of our day-to-day life. And that is a challenge. How do we make our table an altar? How do we make our home a house of God? And now I would like to come to another aspect of our parsha. As I mentioned, our parsha begins by talking about the burnt offering, which is, one could say, parallel to last week's parsha, which also began with the burnt offering. But if we look carefully at our parsha, in the opening verses, although it mentions the burnt offering, the focus is on the fire that's on the altar. And in fact, the term which appears a number of times is Esh Tamit, an eternal fire. In a previous podcast, I have noted the relationship between two parshiot that have very similar names. Parshat Tzav, our parsha, and Parshat Titzaveh, which is at the end of the book of Shmot. Both of them have names related to the idea of being commanded. Both of them focus on the priesthood. And in a previous podcast, I went into great detail talking about the idea of how the priesthood is rooted in commandedness, because the priests cannot do anything in the temple of their own volition. The script is dictated. Everything is regimented. They have to follow the rules. As I've noted, there's no such thing as a creative service. But what I would like to look at now is how in our parsha, we begin with the idea of Esh Tamid, an eternal fire. And in Parshat Titzaveh, what we speak about at the very beginning of the parsha is the Ner Tamid, an eternal light. In Parshat Titzaveh, we speak of the lighting of the menorah. The lighting of the menorah was done towards the end of the day, the daylight hours. And in the opening section of Parshat Titzaveh, it speaks of how this light must be from evening to the morn, an eternal light. It is very interesting that the eternal light is connected with the burning of that light the whole evening. In our parsha, we are not talking about the menorah, we are talking about the altar, which is used for the sacrifices, which is in the courtyard. And there we emphasize not the light, but the esh, the fire, an eternal fire. That fire should continue burning throughout the night. It is worth noting that the service in the temple was done from dawn to dusk, during the daylight hours. No service can be done once it's dark. And yet, both in Parshat Titzaveh and in our Parsha, there is the idea that what began during the day should continue throughout the night. The lighting of the menorah is done during the day, but it is for the purpose of it continuing to burn through the night. The sacrifices are brought during the day, yet they continue to burn through the night. And it is important to keep that fire of the altar burning throughout the night. In a previous podcast, I mentioned how the priests have an especially acute sense of time awareness. And it's actually based on a rabbinic comment in our parsha, which says tzav. When the word tzav is used, it means miyad ulidorot, immediately and for generations. The rabbis see the priests as being people who are diligent, who when they have a job to do, they try to do it immediately, quickly but thoroughly, quickly but methodically, because they value each moment and they appreciate how to maximize the utilization of each moment. But the priests also have a sense of eternity, tamid. They are part of a chain of priests. Each priest sees himself as being the son of, the father of. They are not just individuals. They are part of a whole line. What they're doing is part of an ongoing service of God. What they are doing is trying to maintain the presence of God forever in their midst, so that on the one hand, they are conscious of the importance of every moment, and at the same time, realize the impact every moment can have on eternity. But today I want to focus on another aspect of tamid. Not eternity in terms of generational, but eternity in terms of each day. Although the service is done during the day, it continues into the night. And the night is seen as an extension of that service. And I would like to focus on a very interesting, two interesting halachot that are at the beginning of our parsha, which have to do with the ashes on the altar. At the end of the night, when the sacrifices have been burned, when the wood on the altar has been consumed, and what is left are ashes, there are two laws of the Kohanim. One is Trumat Hadeshen, the lifting up of the ashes. The Kohen, at the end of the night, just before dawn, needs to take a sampling, a token amount of ashes, raise it up. This is the idea of truma, to lift it up, and then to deposit it at the side of the altar. The lifting up of the ashes is a kind of consecration of the ashes. And placing it by the side of the altar is a way of saying that I have in effect brought the previous day's service to an end. I've created a closure. The fact that every single day this was done creates a sense of continuity of each day's service. There's a second thing, which is done by the Kohen, not wearing his priestly garments, which is to remove the ashes from the altar, or if not to remove them, to at least organize them in the center of the altar in a very aesthetic way. This is known as Hotza'at HaDeshen. And the removal of the ashes, which is also done before the morning, is to prepare the altar for the new day, for a fresh service. So that while, on the one hand, we brought a closure to the previous day, we brought a closure through a service which connects what we do each day to what came before, we also do something else which shows how each day is new, how each day is fresh, how each day is special. So what can we learn from this? I think that what this teaches us is that in our own lives, we are very, very active in doing many things. When it comes to the night, we wind down. But again, if we take the priests as models, the activity that we do during the day is activity of mitzvah, of doing all kinds of deeds which are in service of God, in service of our fellow human beings. And in fact, the daytime is when we should actually be involved in doing. But it shouldn't be that when the day is over, we then just crash. But somehow, that light, that fire, should continue into the night. It is interesting that the Rambam, Maimonides, actually speaks about how one's Torah, essential Torah, should be studied at night. If the daytime is a time for doing, the night is especially a time for reflection, for study, for cultivating my soul, perhaps for stock-taking. The fire of the altar, fire is the passion. The light of the menorah is the illumination, the insights which we have. Nighttime is a time for reflection, for gaining insight. It is also a time for keeping that fire alive, that passion. I will end with one point, because this Shabbat is also what's known as Shabbat HaGadol, the Great Shabbat. And there are many explanations which are given as to why it is Shabbat HaGadol. According to the classic rabbinic understanding, this Shabbat was the 10th of Nisan when the Jews left Egypt. The 10th of Nisan, as it is stated in chapter 12 of Exodus, the day where the Jews were told to take the lamb, which 4 days later they would sacrifice and eat. The taking of the lamb on that day was a major test of the Jews, a test of faith, because the lamb was held as sacred in Egypt. The Jews were about to take that lamb for the purpose of slaughtering it to God. Were the Jews ready to break with Egyptian values? Were the Jews ready to potentially endanger their lives for their belief in God? The Jews, on the 14th day, brought this animal as a sacrifice in the afternoon, and then stayed up the night, first eating the sacrifice, and then waiting for the redemption to happen. In that first Seder, the Jews became a kingdom of priests, doing what the priests would do. And that became the basis for our Jewish peoplehood. I wish us all that when we go to experience our Seder, the Seder, which I have noted in other contexts, is the quintessential Jewish meal, which more than any other meal we have during the year, brings us into the realm of the priests, that our Seder should be a powerful religious experience that bonds us to God, to our families, and to the Jewish people for all generations. Shabbat Shalom and Chag Pesach Kasher V'Sameach.
Thank you, Rabbi Schrager. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.